I'd like to take a moment to introduce our panelists here. We have David Ginsberg, VP of Supply Chain at Sonic, and he has 25 years of experience in digitalization of supply chain. We also have a late addition, John Cowley from TTI, doing data science, and he's been implementing data-driven techniques to unlock business growth and revenue. Then we have Jonathan Parker, VP of Sales at Online Components. And he has experience in delivering and implementing innovative solutions to unlock new market opportunities. Then we have Jim Ricardelli. I think Jim doesn't like to call himself a consultant, but he definitely advises industry CEOs on how to achieve revenue growth via digital techniques. And then last but not least, Patrick Stringer. He's Senior Director of Distribution Sales for the Americas for Yageo Group, and he too has experience in implementing digital strategies to achieve new levels of efficiency in the field. And this panel session is being led by Jackie Maddox from Women in Electronics. I am the father of a 12-year-old girl who is into STEM, and I'm very thankful for organizations like Jackie's that they provide content and programming for women in electronics. So, Jackie, I'll let you take it away.
Okay, well, thank you everyone for being here, and thank you to our panelists. We started prep on this panel during the holiday season, so everybody rallied. We all had a lot of great discussion, and to start first to say, why is it that Tony would have me from Women in Electronics moderating a panel about digital transformation and integration? And the whole reason why is change. So with Women in Electronics, we're working through systemic change, as well as the digital conversation is a change in the industry. And so we are at an inflection point. And so from this point forward, all the problems we have, all the challenges we face right here in this room is where it can all be solved. So having the conversations are the first step. Our last initial speaker he ended on something that I loved. He talked about passion. And I think the reason all of us are here today, most of us have a passion for this industry. It's amazing. Our output is amazing. The end products, the medical equipment, all the advancements in the world. That's why we're here today, because our end goal is innovation. So we are the critical thinkers at the table. Our panelists, thankfully, are bringing all their expertise, all their knowledge, all their industry experience. We have put a lot of thought and dedication into this conversation and would love to think through this. Look at this as a think tank, an opportunity to think through some challenges and barriers we face with digital integration. So with that, wanted to give you that premise, and we will start our discussion. So, first of all, what is the need for digital transformation, digital integration, as people say? So what is the need for that, and what is the state of the industry? So let's just start with that. And with that, I will turn to maybe David, I'll start with you. And everybody, if you could just take 2 minutes, why are you here? Why are we having this discussion today? And what's the why for this?
For me, nothing moves faster than a digital supply chain. We run a electronics manufacturing factory using in excess of 1 million parts a week, and digital can buy it within seconds, minutes, deliver it within days, run 24/7. So again, there's nothing faster, nothing more responsive, adaptive, agile. It's the path that supply chain has to go down. We simply couldn't do business the old-fashioned way.
Okay, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think COVID really exposed our industry as a whole to just how fragile it really is. One unfortunate worldly event really turned our world upside down. And I quickly noticed the why was for a couple of different reasons. The data and the information that our industry has at its disposal can be the difference whether a medical device makes it to the market or not. It is the difference in some life-saving device, you know, being in our world every single day. And you know, supply chain got so disrupted through that mechanism that we saw how important data was. We saw how important it was to communicate it in a timely manner. And so I think that's where we're at. We're at this point where we employ team members who can do more and have more value to this business, but they're stuck doing this role of moving data back and forth. And they can provide more, they can do more, and that information's there. It's just stuck in a silo and we need to get it out.
Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, everything we do in our industry and the supply chain is based around speed, right? What's your lead time? How quickly can you respond? Can you expedite this? And so the only way that you can truly utilize, you know, speed is with the data that we have and do it efficiently. And combining those two, then we can give that information to our customer base and improve and truly be able to deliver our supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's all of those things, certainly. Speed for sure, but it's also scale. You know, Chris touched on this a little bit in his opening remarks. The reality is that, you know, Japan's already seen a demographic cliff, and it's here in the US as well. It's here in most of the Western world. As much as we all love our industry and think it's the coolest thing, I entered the industry in 1995, and the reason why I chose this industry versus some of the others that I had the opportunity to enter was because even then, you know, electronics and technology was at the cutting edge. And today, nothing in the world is getting less electronics in it. Everything in the world is getting more electronics in it. And if we don't digitize things and enable our industry and our supplier partners, our customer partners, and other folks in the channel to be able to adjust to the ever-increasing level of business, then we're not going to be able to keep up. And so I think it's a need just for all of us to be able to remain viable and attract new talent and things like that and have those folks be as productive as possible.
Jim?
May I make, I'll take 1 second to explain. Wilmer said, I'm a consultant. Who doesn't want to be a consultant? If I can address that quickly. Prior to starting my consulting business 2 years ago, I was executive vice president at DigiKey, running the digital business for 8 years, and prior to that at Arrow, 5 years on their corporate strategy team. And I've spent a lot of money in my career with the big guys, McKinsey's, Cognizant, and I decided there's an opportunity to be a smaller, more boutique consultant to help companies not have to spend all that money to go figure out digital strategy. So here I am. To me, so I've got a view really through distributors and suppliers, what's digital strategy, and we're, as we all know, we're in a massive growing industry, and there's going to be winners and losers. And if you don't adapt digital, you're going to be left behind. And for me, it's, you know, I look at David down here who talked about speed as a customer. Companies have to delight their customers. And we all learned way back with Jeff Bezos, he found new ways to delight customers. And we've got to be thinking about how can we delight our customers? Because if we don't figure out how to do it differently, faster, more effectively, someone's going to come in and do it instead of us. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's about making sure you're on the winning side of that formula.
So from what I've heard from everybody is we need accurate data and we need it quickly. And we need that. It's essential for innovation for that to happen. So, but before I go on to the next question, where are we now in the industry that you feel? So here we have this opportunity to get information to our customers in a more accurate way, in a more timely way. But where are we now with this whole process with digitizing our supply chain? So what do you think about that? Where are we? We talked about the mountains. Like, where are we? Are we at base camp? Are we? What stage are we at? So maybe one or two of you can comment on that.
Well, right now, I'd say we're in silos for the mm-hmm. most part. We're in silos on how companies think about problems and certainly where the data is. Mm-hmm. In creating, you know, business processes to get outside of these silos, I think is the opportunity.
Yep.
I'll steal from Ed there for a second. I think we're like in the dating phase. You know, there's, as a distributor partner in this whole supply chain ecosystem, we have to go to hundreds of manufacturers to ask for information, and we're still trying to figure out how to communicate with them. We're still trying to figure out their language versus our language, how to get it into our system. How do we get it into our system and get it, you know, to the digital ecosystem where it makes sense to the customer? So I think we're still in a very early stage of even trying to connect all these sources of information in a way to where we're all speaking the same language, it's all being translated the same way, and it's actually delivering value to these customers and they can actually do something with it.
Yeah, I would kind of jump off that, and you asked the question, you know, going back to Ed's presentation, are we at the first base camp, the last base camp at a peak of the valley? Yes. Right? It depends, you know, just as you were saying, across the suppliers that we have on our line card, some are fully capable of providing us with information at the speed of business via APIs, and others, you know, send us flat files on a stone tablet. Not really, but, you know.
I'm not far from it.
Yeah.
Right, and it's that way with our customers as well, you know. I think David and Sonic are at one end of the extreme, but there's a lot of folks that are at the complete other end of the extreme and live in Excel files. And I think it's, you know, as we talked about, we're the thought leaders in the industry. It's up to us to try and think of ways to create solutions that allow everyone to come along for the journey so that we don't have we don't further create a digital divide that leaves people behind.
Very good point. Okay, so let's talk about this then. So there's a reason. There's a reason that people are hesitant. There's a reason that we have not fully transformed, a lot of very valid reasons, but also very fear-based maybe in some cases. Fear causes us to really stop in our tracks, and it becomes a fight or flight, and we see that quite a bit. When we take opportunities to do events like this, we're actually pausing and planning. And that's what I love about coming together at events like this, is because you have the major thinkers at the table. And I really believe that all the problems and barriers can be overcome by bringing the thinkers to the table. So I love the fact that we're pausing for a minute and we're going to make a plan for how we're moving forward very effectively, because as a team, as an industry, as what was mentioned earlier, we need to do this together. Mm-hmm. We cannot do this in silos. And to come to the table regularly with thought leadership conversations is going to be our saving grace through the relationships and through the teamwork. So with that, I'm going to ask the second question. What are those concerns and what are the barriers? So I'm going to lead with John on this one.
So I think, yeah, right, change management is difficult in every scenario, regardless of what we're talking about, changing from analog to digitizing the supply chain or, you know, anything else. And so I think we have to think about human nature. Most people are resistant to change, and it's up to us to think about how we message the why, the so what. So we're wanting to do this because it will deliver these benefits. And really, from a people side of things, I think it's important for us, and this is something we talk about at TTI as we're looking to integrate our solutions into the business, is it's not you or this tool. Because I think a lot of people, the news doesn't help, right? Talking about, you know, AI is going to replace you, and it's not, you know, we understand how it works. It's really cool. It's really good. It does a lot of things, but it's nowhere near replacing humans. And so helping people understand that it's you and the tool, and it's you to the power of the tool. It's helping people scale and be able to do more to keep up with the pace and volume of our business. And then again, on the system side of things, I think it's trying to think about and be very thoughtful, and as we're creating these solutions, to try and be inclusive as much as we can and create adaptable solutions that allow other folks that may not be nearly as far along on the curve as others to continue to participate.
Okay, so David, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I'd say that that's absolutely right. And Getting the objective right so that it can be passed down. I think when we say digital supply chain, maybe everybody in the room is thinking of something else. You know, is it a control tower? Is it industry 4.0? Is it AI? What is digital supply chain? And for me, it's a very practical thing. It's taking the existing processes, purchasing, planning, order management, receiving, invoicing, automating that so that the computer can behave autonomously. Mm-hmm. And if you state it as those functional goals, it becomes very easy for everybody downstream to understand what's going on. If it's left at the lofty digital supply chain, probably everybody at the board level is going to have a different opinion. So making it tangible, I think, is beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was just going to say, you know, when we transformed a portion of our business from being very manual and multiple source to being digital, the biggest concern for every stakeholder in the process was fear of losing control. Mm-hmm. And it was, and our IT department was like, well, how are we going to control from a cybersecurity perspective all this data? Mm-hmm. You know, how are, from a product perspective, from our business groups, they were like, well, you know, who's going to control the margin and the price? And I used to always joke with them, we're going to replace you with a robot, because they were always the biggest challenge of the whole process. But then it was the sales team, and they were like, well, how am I going to see my opportunities, and how are we going to close deals? So it was always trying to, you know, keep people from their fear of losing control of the process. And that was one of the biggest concerns that I always saw.
I'm not sure if any of the other panelists has something to say about this, but I, in talking to some of you, we started talking about change management. This is a form, the digital conversation is a form of change. And so it's that leadership table. So you mentioned the control, the fear. Are we sitting together within our organizations? Are we even in alignment at that leadership table, and who is at that table making these decisions? Because if the leadership table is not on board, it is never going to go up throughout the organization, and we will never have the employees understanding and knowing how they can directly be a part of this solution. It's like, it made me think about it when he was talking about the team going on the mountain. Everybody's got their own part, and this is how change management works. But if the leader on top, you know, Ed was saying he worked backwards. I love that. I always do that as well. I love working backwards. But are we looking at that and working backwards with the problem? Are we saying, what is it we're trying to accomplish, and working backwards from how to get there? And do people know in the organization what they can do to be a part of the solution, mm-hmm. instead of having the fear, mm-hmm. empowering them with the solution? So that leadership conversation, I think, is so critical to change management. But I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is, right? It starts with clarity and vision for understanding where you want to go and how you want to get there at the top, and then clearly articulating that out to the team so that you can get buy-in over time, right? That's part of the change management process. You can't expect to flip a switch and everybody expect everyone to be on board right away. And it absolutely starts at the top. And I think that it's important for leaders in each of the businesses in the industry to invest the time to understand how these things work, what is possible, what isn't possible, the so what, the why, what benefits can be derived from it, so that they can be very consistent and clear in the messaging out to the folks to help people be comfortable with that journey that we're all on together.
Yeah, we're in this change management journey now, and it's fun because I have Dan at my side with this journey in particular, but we're going through this process of automating some of the simple stuff, the, you know, POs, the stuff that's just very basic. And it's been challenging because most people seem to think like, well, like, what am I here for? And you know, we've tried to share that message. We continue to share that message. Like, you have more to offer. You can bring more. Like, use your time better. And what's been successful is continually showing them how the technology can do 80, 90% of the work. Mm-hmm. and you can repurpose the 80 or 90% of your time now that you have back to your day. It's been beneficial to have stakeholders like Dan and the Orbeaver team help us through that journey, but in parallel to that, we bring them into those meetings, we bring them into those conversations. We show that we have partners that are gonna take our hand in this journey, and if you've got something, like, we're not alone, they're here. If something happens midstream, midway down the line of this whole journey, like, we've got a resource, we've got someone that wants to help us get through this.
It's a really good point, because we were thinking about that recently with looking at the C-suite and looking at the leadership table. How many organizations actually have a systems person, their data person at the table, at the leadership decision-making table? I don't know that a lot of organizations have incorporated that, and many times we're talking about the problem without those people who could help solve it right there, making business decisions. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing to maybe think about too, is what does that table look like and how are we forming our teams? You mentioned team. Who is it that has gotten to a certain point and who can go to certain levels on the mountain but just can't get all the way there? I think this is part of the issue we have to address too, and this is the squirmy wormy in your seat. We talked about success of this event and what does that look like, and if we're not squirming a little bit, if we're not having a little bit of the tough conversations, then we came together for just a networking event and not a thought leadership event. So I think the thought leadership part of it too is, who is it that have come along with us to this point but really just can't make it to the summit? Mm-hmm. So those are questions every organization has to make for themselves, but to carry people along, just to carry them along, it's death. As he mentioned on the mountain, that's death. So these are the really tough conversations and the things to be looking at as we're moving forward in our industry and we're evolving. What got us here won't get us there. We have amazing seasoned leaders and we need them. We need them more now than ever because we have a lot of new talent to mentor up. So we need them there, but who are the ones that are going to get us to the summit? So those are for individual questions for you to answer for your own organizations. So with that, I'm going to go to the next question and address Jonathan. So we're talking about, we're here saying we have an opportunity for transformation, but what's the risk? So we know that there's some potential, barriers and all that. What is the risk in acting, of not acting, actually, I should say? What's the risk if we don't act? So we get paralyzed. That fear is what I mentioned from before. It just stops us in our tracks. And because we've been so successful as an industry, success is your first step to failure, always. Because then you think you're on the top and you're just going to stay there. It's really not true. So what's the risk we have if we let our fear stop us and we don't move forward with transforming?
I mean, in short form, and I've tossed with this one a lot because there's a ton of risk. But when you really take a second and just boil it all the way down to, it's just very basic. The risk is not if, it's you will get left behind. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I try to communicate that with folks, and it's, you will get left behind. And the moment that you make that decision to go, okay, let's play this game, let's try to get caught up, just when you think you got caught up, you're going to be wrong. Because the ones that are doing this well have already made the decision to do it. They've already gotten to that point. And the ones that are smart and do it well don't stop there.
Yeah.
So they automatically look for those, well, how can I be beaten at the game that I just won? And at the rate of innovation and change and transformation that we're going through, it's almost virtually impossible to get caught up, because everything goes so much faster. The speed, the data, everything's right there to where when someone gets it, they've got the foundation, they've got it all, and they can move much quicker. And I started thinking about this a little bit differently last night in particular, because I was like, how can I take this kind of thought and actually like translate it? And I started thinking about Uber and taxis. And I think we can all kind of go through this experience. Like, it's not so old. We talk Blockbuster, Circuit City, Radio Shack. There's Toys R Us. We talk about those, but we're living through an experience right now where you can compare in real time. You have Uber and you have taxis. We've probably all taken both. But I took a minute to look back and looked at the numbers.
Yeah.
And Uber was founded in 2009 and had already outpaced the revenue of the taxi cab industry by 2011.
Wow.
I'm sorry, 2020, 11 years later. So it just goes to show in the numbers, if you really want to know them, because I wrote them down because I'm fascinated with numbers and I feel like I have to bring something to the table here. In 2020, the taxi industry was worth $10 billion. And in 2020, the Uber industry was worth $12 billion. Mm. Now, I talked about the rate of change and the rate of speed. 3 years later, 2023, the taxi industry is worth $20 billion and Uber is $36 billion. So that change, that rate of speed, if you want to start playing and you're just now coming to the table and you're late, you're probably always going to be late, and then you're going to be racing to a margin pressure game and a pricing war, and it's not a successful recipe for anybody's business, I would imagine.
Right, and so that goes back to who, you know, we're going to address this in a little bit, but who are we serving? And at some point, the customers want that accurate, fast data. So whoever can provide them with that is who they're going to be working with, really. And that's why it is. I'm always fascinated about the Blockbuster example, just because, and I've said it to the panelists, it's really interesting because, you know, my kids growing up, we went every Friday night to Blockbuster. We would go to dinner, go to Blockbuster, get our movie. And when Blockbuster was presented with digitizing, with taking their model to a Netflix kind of model, it could have been a collaboration moment for everyone to thrive and everyone to win. But they shunned it because they were like, we're on our game, we're good, we're the leaders. No, now where are they now? So the message is also sometimes success could make us so blind to what our true competition is, and we can't get comfortable in that space. We always need to be thinking of, how do I innovate? How do I change? How do I grow? How do I do it different? And even our industry models, to look at the model we have created in this supply chain, is it the best model moving forward? Do we need to innovate at this point? So these are the thought leadership conversations to have. The other thing too, I just want to bring up, maybe somebody can address this, but we've talked a lot about retention, youth. I mean, we have a big gap, a leadership gap that's coming. It hasn't quite hit us yet, although we've been talking about it. How does this conversation impact the next generation coming in? I don't know if anybody wants to comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you ask risk. And I think part of the risk, you know, there, like I said, there's a list of them, but I think part of the risk is if you're behind the times, not even the leadership aspect, but just the next generation of talent, the risk is you become less attractive to the market. Mm-hmm. I started in the business at Allied, and I walked into Allied on my first day and it was a blue screen and I'm like, what is this? What is this, DOS? Like, I don't even know DOS, but it's blue. Like, what is this? Like, immediately I'm like, oh, did I make a bad decision? Like, I really started questioning things. And so, you know, I think about that in today's environment where speed is just insanely quick now and, like, everything's changing. And I go, if I'm going to hire the next talent pool out of whatever up-and-coming university or whatever the movement is of the industry, do I even have a system that's going to be attractive to them to even want to come work for me, like, or come want to work with me, or want to come down this journey if, you know, they got to learn in a completely new language or code to even make this work? So, yeah, I think you risk your reputation, you risk your attractiveness to the market. Us on our side as a distributor, suppliers want to work with people that are doing this. Like, they want to partner with people that are making that transformative turn because it's beneficial to them as well. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of risks. I mean, just aside from the attractiveness of your business to the up-and-coming youth.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move on to the next question, and I'm going to address Jim with this. And I kind of mentioned organizational structure, leadership, huge part of this transformation. I'm going to start with you on this one and just say, you know, what does the modern successful organization look like? How can, what structure can support this change?
You know, I think the key word is dynamic, right? Companies have to become more dynamic from the top all the way through the entire organization. And what does that mean? Well, what it doesn't mean is, you know, we all grew up in hierarchical organizations, where you have marketing, sales, operations, logistics, IT. And when the CEO comes in and says, we need a new initiative on digital strategy, they all run off, potentially could run off and start doing their own thing, which I think is the world we've all lived in over the last couple of decades. So being more dynamic, and I loved what Ed talked about, right? Is it implicit trust amongst the executive team? So when the board of directors says to the CEO, or asks the question, what's your digital strategy? And the CEO has a vision, a great story to tell, whether it's we want to delight customers in more efficient ways, or we want a lower cost to be lower cost supplier. Whatever that story is, you've got to have a strong CEO who can tell the story, and then an executive team who can develop the plan together. But the rope's connected to them, implicit trust, as Ed described. Versus running off and saying, this is how marketing is going to do it, this is how IT is going to do it. Because I think today that a lot of that's going on, where by the time it gets down to the teams that have to really make this work, you know, what typically happens is you pass it on to the SMEs, right, the subject matter experts, and they're listening from their leader, what is the right way to approach this, not a solid plan that's been thought through by the executive team as one single group. And then the SMEs start saying, okay, we want to become digitally transformed. And what I see quite often is these are 20-year veterans in the company that know the processes, know the workflows. And what they do is they come back after days of meetings, potentially paying big money to one of the large consultants, and they come back and say, we just lowered 20 steps in the process to 18 steps, but they didn't blow up the process, right? So executives, so kind of back up on the leadership, knowing exactly what the story is, what the vision is, executive team that can come up with the plan, and then finding the right change agents in the organization. Hopefully they are the SMEs, but the ones that are bold enough and understand blowing up the old way of doing workflows and processes is really important. I haven't met many companies like that, so it's an opportunity, I believe.
And it's really more kind of a flattening of the organizations and allowing that collaboration, not all top down, but very collaborative type of environment. Really difficult, because I think somebody had mentioned also the critical questions at that leadership table addressing the pain points in the company. And are the leaders really asking those questions? Where are our pain points? And really getting to that and giving the freedom for people to be able to express where that is. So these are some critical topics to really think through. And even thinking of IT, let me just turn it to the panelists. So I know, like, up until this point, IT was just kind of like a department, right? But now it's kind of essential in our new businesses moving forward. So I know I'll just let one or two of you comment on any final thoughts on this before we move on.
Yeah, I mean, so, right, IT typically owns the infrastructure and tools that enable all of this to happen. And so without a real partnership in integration into the business and flattening of the organization like we just spoke about, it's very challenging for that to work. It just is, you know? I think that they need to understand the needs of the business, as you described, what are the pain points from the top down? What is the big problem that we're trying to solve? And how do we get there? What are the tools that exist today that we have? What are the capabilities that exist today that we have? And what do we need to bridge the gap?
Yeah, you know, once again, it's the collaboration. One of the red flags I see going into companies is when they say, who owns the digital strategy? Is it marketing or IT? Well, let's bring in a VP of e-commerce so that person can referee between the two groups. I mean, it's the kiss of death. Don't ever take that job. And it's gonna be a leader of IT, a leader of marketing, a leader of whatever the teams are that work together as one unit. I'm gonna keep bringing up the rope. They have to have ropes and they have to have the same pace. It's what Ed described, climbing the mountain. It's, you've gotta have a dynamic leadership team that works together. And certainly IT is a big part of it, right? Having the right tools and technology.
And really, I think this is a good forum to ask these tough questions, but how do we address the blockers? Because if you picture that mountain and everybody's roped to each other, and then you've got somebody literally cutting off somebody's rope, that's what it is. So I don't know that in our industry we do address the blockers. We really don't, and we just allow the same mindsets to go on. And this is not a men or women conversation because both have this issue. So how is it that we're looking at our organizations and really addressing the blockers? It could be in the leadership team, you know, how awful is that? But then it could be just another layer or so down, and that's all it takes to sabotage. If you have the freshest stream imaginable, the purest water, and you put a tiny little drop of poison, the whole thing is ruined. So what is it we could say? Do we have anything in place to address blockers?
I mean, I would say my experience was always, you know, normally in those situations, we go head on against those blockers and we create confrontation, and then we end up going around them, right? But what I found was the most successful situation was find out their pain point, what's really their pain point, and then try to help include them in providing a solution for that pain point. And then once you win their, once you win them over, then they become a part of the total solution. And I've seen it happen. I've seen someone who was totally against, you know, what you were trying to do, now come on board and be your advocate.
We've experienced that at Women Electronics. We have some of our biggest blockers have become our biggest advocates, because usually once people understand something and you take the fear out, people come around. But we also have learned from some experts in change management, some leading experts at many organizations, even outside of our industry, is that there needs to be very solid, healthy, proactive rewards and consequences. So I think that we're trying to do really good with those rewards, and I think as an industry we're really good about trying to make it work with people. I don't think we do as well with the disciplinary part. So that's why we get some people in some leadership positions that just stay there forever, but truly are blockers. Maybe they haven't been encouraged enough to come around, but at some point there is a need to just say, this isn't working out. You can come climb the mountain next time when you're ready, maybe. But for this time, you got to turn back around, right? And we just got to go forward with this other team. Those are the really tough conversations. And the people that are in this room that took the time to come here and participate and be involved, you know, what are the takeaways beyond this event? What do you take with you? What do you evaluate? How do you reflect and decide this for yourself and your organizations and your teams?
Right. And if you don't have a flat organization, that gets really hard. It's like it could be 6-7 levels down from the executive team. You don't even know what's happening.
It's so true.
Is this thing, why isn't anyone adopting our new idea? It's and it's so entrenched down. That's why the flattening of the organization is important. And sometimes the block is outside the company. I have a story I shared with Tim, I'll share it with the group, where it was someone outside the company where, you know, one of my clients launched some new quoting tools so that the customers can now interface with them, self-serve, immediate response. And the salespeople are like, oh no, I gotta be in the middle, I've got the relationship. And we thought we'd get over that. And then, but still adoption was slow. So sales manager went out to some customers to talk to them, and this one customer sitting in a room with the purchasing manager and the buyers, and purchasing manager basically listened to the idea of this new quoting tool, creating new workflows, and the purchasing manager said, hey, all you're telling me is you want us to do your work. We're sending your team the spreadsheets, they process them, you get most of the business anyways, why would you want to change this? And then shut down the meeting. Mm-hmm. Later in the day, the buyers called the sales manager and said, what you presented to us is exactly what we want. Mm-hmm. We'll deal with our boss, but we need to have a more efficient, more real-time mm-hmm. solution for quoting from your company. So it was the purchasing manager that was blocking us mm-hmm. from adoption. Mm-hmm. Just a story.
Who is the customer and who are we serving, Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a career-long salesperson, so right. I mean, it's easy for me to say that the customer is who I'm calling on. But what I found in this whole process, when we had this transformation in my former company, well, it still is, but we were acquired. But most of my customers were really internally. It was this business group. It was my accounting team. It was IT. It was senior leadership. You know, I spent more time selling things to them internally than I did really, the customer who I was truly calling on. So there's so many different stakeholders, and they are all your constituents to some degree. And if I wanted to be successful in what I was trying to do, I had to sell all of them.
Mm-hmm. So I also think that you made a really good point. We were talking the other day about what was that example you said about, this transformation. It's major if you have, say, a security hack or something like that, a data breach. Tell that example.
Yeah. So I was just saying, when we went through this project with OrgWeaver and Fernando and I worked together on this a long time, and it was a big planning process, and I thought we were really good at. We spent a ton of time planning and preparing, and it was a solid plan. But I look back on it, and the one thing we never really talked about it, but what if an event happened, a cyber event, and we experienced that a year ago down the line. Luckily, Fernando, you didn't have to live through that, but I did. Our company got hacked and ransomware. So everything from manufacturing to order entry to quoting systems, and I run our distribution business, it was shut down for like a month. Yeah. Like I couldn't even provide a response to someone, even if they wanted information, I couldn't obtain it until we finally got through that. And that was the one thing that we didn't really role play, or we talked about it, but we didn't plan, because everybody thought it was going to be it. All of the other portions of our company took care of that, but it was a huge undertaking, and we lost all that data. Right, we talk about data, all that was gone for that period of time.
That's a really good point to make when we're going into these transformations. Make that plan, because it's not if, it's when. We're just in this age now, and it is really when something goes awry. So what is that plan? Factoring that in as you're building your transformation plan, that maybe that the best practice is to act, but make your plan for something that could go wrong. So that's a good point too. But I would like to, before we get to the final question about more best practices, because I think that's where we are right now. It's like, okay, what's some of the best practices to move forward and to talk together as a group? But before that, there's so much involved, and I feel like each of these questions could be a whole separate session in itself. But we talk about talent, we're talking about leadership, and we're talking about all these things that's so critical to have, right, in going through these transformations. But if we look at the future skills needed, we look at our industry, the state of the industry, where we are now, we look at where we want to go, we look at who we're serving, who's our customers. Just a little pause real quick, I just came from CES, and it was super fascinating for me walking around and looking at all the innovation we're responsible for that. These conversations in this room are directly impacting the globe, and I don't really think that we stop and think about that all the time in our industry, the impact on the globe and how those people at CES are so dependent on us having this conversation right now. It really is fascinating, and a huge opportunity for us to be the pioneers, to be the ones that actually took that leading edge and took the leaps of faith and are the ones who made those legacy leadership decisions to transform and to move into the future in a way that's going to impact everybody in such a positive way. So, but with that, what are the skills needed? We talked about the team, and somebody asked the question about how did you know who the right team members were? What do we need? What are the skills needed at the table right now? And I'll have every one of you answer because I think it's so critical.
Yeah, so I think, you know, assuming you've got a CEO that has the great vision, can tell the story, has an executive team that works well together, and then you pass it on to the organization, you need people that are really good with critical thinking, mm-hmm. right? That can challenge current processes, willing to blow up current processes and not just tweak what's happening and saying we could do this quicker if we tweak this one thing. It's rethinking how you do things. So critical thinking is what I would say.
Yep. John?
Yeah, and I would say absolutely critical thinking. And it's, you know, when we look at the next generation that has entered the workforce, is entering the workforce, they have very different desires and wants in general than what a lot of us in this room have. They want experiences. They want to be continuous learners. They want to be challenged. They want to contribute earlier, perhaps. And I think there's a real opportunity. You know, earlier I talked about thinking about the tools that we create and that any digitization of anything, the promise that it delivers is that it will automate the rote, the boring, the repetitive tasks, which most people don't want to do. You know, we're in a transition globally where, you know, in manufacturing it occurred many, many years ago, offshoring and moving things to different areas. But it's now hitting the knowledge economy. And what that looks like, it's scary for a lot of people, but what it looks like is, again, automating the repetitive tasks that we just threw people at in the past, and now we can automate that, which frees up people's time for doing those higher level skills. And so I think it's the answer is critical thinking. I think it's people that have a little bit of knowledge in a lot of areas as opposed to more specialization. Mm. And then that does two things. It enables us to solve the challenging problems moving forward as an industry, but it also allows us to be more attractive to the next workforce and recruiting them. I mean, the reality is, you know, from my perspective, I've been in this industry for almost 30 years, and the reason I chose it right out of college was because it is cool, and we work with a lot of cool customers doing a lot of cool things. Mm-hmm. For the next generation leaving college now, they may want to go to work for a software development company building an app, but is an app that allows you to schedule someone to clean up your dog's mess in the backyard really any cooler than some of the things that our customers are building? No. It's cool because it's leading edge and it's other things, but I think digitizing things gives us that opportunity to do that and be attractive to the next generation. So
I never really thought about that, but I think that was an excellent point to hire people who can learn and be cross-departmental and they're not just siloed. I think one of the most ineffective situations that occurred over the last 10, 20, well, probably 30 years was sales and marketing. Mm-hmm. Just like, no, that's sales. No, that's marketing. It was very ineffective. All that's combining now. And so hiring people that actually can learn how to do different functions is so critical. Patrick, I'll turn it to you.
Yeah. I mean, all of this is true. And you know, what I found is really it start, you know, from a leadership perspective, it you know, if you want to transform change, you really need to be open and listen to whoever's out in the organization that potentially has some advantage or some way to innovate. I mean, at our company, it started with a young person that just went to work in customer service in Macedonia. He created one function to try to make his life easier. And then it was enough for his manager and then their boss and their boss to listen and say, wow, you know, we don't know everything that we're doing. Let's listen to this young person who just came up with this new step and made our company more successful, and then take that and innovate with it. And so I think it's critical that our leaders are listening to whoever it is, somebody on the shop floor, somebody, you know, in the office somewhere, and they don't know everything, or we don't know everything that we think we know.
That's a great point too, Jonathan.
I'm kind of living through it in one aspect, but I don't think we create the space. I think we go through these moments of like, oh, that'd be really cool, or oh, that would be really neat if we could do that. And you're sitting in a board meeting or sitting in an executive meeting and you talk about it for 15, 20 minutes and you go back to your day-to-day world and you don't actually spend the time, you don't create the space to say, well, let's try that, let's talk about that more. It's just a moment in a bigger moment. And for me, it's kind of interesting because like I always get excited when somebody says, what if? I'm like, okay, let's go. Like, this is fun. Or, you know, why does it have to be that way? And I don't think we embrace those moments. I don't think as leadership, I think you've said it a couple of times, like what got us here, the mindset is very complacent in some regard. It's like, this has always worked and the business hasn't changed in 30 years. And, you know, why do we need to do it that way? And I think there's an opportunity to really open the floor to your point and say, like, what's not working? Just tell me. Like, why does it have to be that way? Like, let's open up those moments. Let's open up those conversations to the team members to tell us where we can change and how we can change and who we can partner with to actually do something different and bring value to the world. I mean, you said it. You go to these events and you see the cool stuff that's being made. It's coming off of our industry.
Mm-hmm.
If we can speed that up, just imagine how much cooler or how much more innovation comes to the world.
Yes, and I think that it's interesting because most people, the majority, 90% probably, really want processes, but the processes are what's holding us back. I personally believe in protocols, really solid protocols that encourage critical thinking. So at Women in Electronics, I absolutely refuse to have any kind of processes because I think it gets us stuck in a certain lane. I want everyone to critically think, and I want protocols. We have solid protocols. But that, I think, was a critical point because I think in these organizations, you know, we get so stuck in our processes and the processes are maybe outdated and then it doesn't allow for innovation. So anyway, David, I'll let you comment.
Yeah, so we pick up on this and have formalized it quite a bit. We hire our engineers into operations. So I actually take our programmers and give them a half dozen suppliers to manage, sit them down with operational planning, buying, scheduling, invoice problems, quality problems. They get the works, same as anybody else in planning or purchasing. And by doing this, they develop the business sense so that they can switch between common business language and programming all day long. It allows them to hear the banter in the department when somebody is complaining, an executive comes down the hall and says, you know, what's the problem with this order? You're shutting down the factory. They hear it all and they can code to it. They don't need specification. And I think a lot gets lost in specification. When you have non-technical people sending specifications offshore, waiting 3-6 months to get an answer, it's not exactly workable. They go back to Excel or whatever their other process was. So we stick them right in the center of the action with sink or swim on your suppliers. And they always swim, and it is a pleasure when they reach the point where we're discussing how not to have the same problem twice. They complete my sentence for me and then say, I'm gonna go code this, don't bother me. At that point, I know that critical thinking is in place and they can problem solve, and I'm no longer required to be part of that process.
I'm going to get to the final question because we're going to be running out of time. We had mentioned some best practices, and that's really what we're here for. We will provide after this session a PDF of what we talked about, some of the major takeaway points from our prior discussions and prep, but also what we're talking about here, so you'll have something tangible to go think through and take back to your organizations. But I'm going to lead with David. You know, it's really interesting to me that David is participating in this panel, being on the other side of this change. And so his perspective is so necessary and fascinating to me. So David, I'm going to lead with you. We talked about some of the best practices, but we created a long list of things. And so I, in the limited time we have, I will let turn it over to you to talk through some of those.
Yep. So I started with the list and I whittled it down to a top 10 just for time.
Good. Perfect.
So for me, the starting point is no buzzwords. Define actionable goals. So actionable within supply chain, which is my sole focus for digital, is automating planning, purchasing, order management, change orders, receiving, invoice. Fully automated, autonomous. The computer runs itself, lights out. Keeping it simple, the best starting point is simply have the computer being another buyer or planner in the department following the existing ISO processes. Same authorizations for PPV, excess inventory, on-time delivery. Program it the same way. You're already authorized. You don't have to go for approval. You're just adding staff to the department. Yeah, so we gave the computer the same authorizations and supply chain processes. This limits the need for interdepartmental approvals. I don't have to go back to finance for authorizations. I don't have to go up to the executive team to get more money for approval levels or explain complicated processes. I'm literally having a conversation with the buyers and planners saying, how do you do your job? When are you authorized to place your order? How do you make your decision when you have multiple quotes? And programming the computer to behave the same way. As I mentioned earlier, we got rid of specifications. It's far easier to bring the engineers into operations and allow them to participate in the process and then code to reality. So a coding cycle for us might be anywhere from 1 hour to a day to a week, but it's no longer weeks, months, quarters. So programming has become almost real time on the problem solving. For the times that you have to go outside your span of control, the CEO has to be on board. So our CEO is educated on the supply chain processes to the point that we can switch back and forth between business and what if then statements. So he can half talk in code. So by the time the conversation is done, we know exactly what to code and exactly what the impact on other departments are going to be. The starting point has to be data accuracy. When you're turning the computer on for auto spend, you have to have accurate data. And the one problem with accurate data is it's impossible. So the reality of the world is most of us have databases with millions, billions of records that have to be kept accurate. New, moving, changing, never filled in the first place. You can't hand people keyboards and have it done fast enough. The keyboard is obsolete. Throw away the keyboard. All that the keyboard is good for is a programmer writing the three lines of code that update a million records. But the keyboard cannot update a million records. So it's time to automate data accuracy. And we spent a decade on data accuracy, writing business rules into the system for all of the planning and ordering attributes like lead time, price, source of supply, planner code, buyer code, everything related to the procurement decision. And the most nerve-wracking day of my life was when we turned on the system autonomously, left it to run 24/7, and I went home for that night wondering if I'd have a job in the morning. But if you pay attention to the data accuracy, you do have a job, and life only gets better after that. Once you're plugged into your suppliers, it's two-way communications. As much as, you know, maybe you're focused on procurement and managing all those parts arriving and keeping the factory going, you're getting invaluable information. You're getting the current lead time for the part. Is it active or obsolete? What's the moisture sensitivity level for the industrial engineers? All of these attributes start spreading out to the departments, and the departments start to go, wow, this digital is pretty cool. Now you're getting buy-in because you're helping the other organizations. One of the biggest things that helped was as we started doing digital purchase orders, we were also getting back digital invoices and processing the PO receipts. So you now have the three-way match electronically, have the computer auto match, and you take 50, 60% of the work off of account payables. So their paper matching stacks just plummeted. Now I have an ally in finance. It really does have many unintended benefits. So just start small and let the expansion be later to other departments and other technologies. I'll also say it's not a headcount reduction program. What it does is it takes the busy work off the people's plate so they have time for problem solving. And digital is absolutely pointless if you don't solve the problems. In electronics, I like to say, you know, typical product has 100 different parts on it. Digital could bring in, you know, 90 of those. But if your purchasing team can't get the last 10 at the same speed as the digital supply chain, it's pointless. You've got the invoices ticking on 90% of the parts and no revenue from the product. You can put yourself out of business. So it's never been about reducing headcount. It is about scalability, because on all new business, 70% is going to the computer, 30% to purchasing. Purchasing has the time with the time and the bandwidth to problem solve and apply critical thinking skills, and the whole thing comes together in a very efficient way. Digital is only possible with trust relationships. Your suppliers have to believe in you and believe that you're managing their data correctly. You need integration partners for data transmission that are trusted by both parties. So the whole thing is a trust relationship, and that those trust relationships are also part of problem solving. You need to be able to pick up the phone and solve it, whether it's a technical problem or an operational, you know, I need this part yesterday type problem. But preserving your relationships is absolutely critical to this. And then, you know, final comment is there's simply nothing faster, more responsive, more adaptive. We brought this up pre-COVID, and when COVID hit, it was a beautiful thing to have. While staff was at home and the world is panicking on semiconductors, the digital supply chain is out 24/7, scouring the globe for inventories and placing orders all day long before anybody else could even see the parts. Mm-hmm. So we actually grew during COVID, whereas several of our local competitors went out of business or are suffering from major financial problems now due to the mismatched inventory problems. The agility, the adaptability, all the buzzwords of the industry are embedded in digital. You simply can't keep up with a computer that can scan a million records every hour and look at the globe for components and manage the dates on all your orders. So it's another employee in the department. It's never cost anyone a job, and it's actually improved life. We have five buyers managing the supply chain for 100 Silicon Valley OEMs, and they all go home at five. They all like their job. They all have multi-year tenure. So the entire work environment changes for the better with digital.
David, him being here right now, is such a good resource. He speaks to this topic and has some resources. So David, I think when we send out our follow-up and we send out information, it would be good to see if we can get some of your resources for the group. So hit up David for any questions. And thanks to really, you know, the team for bringing this expert panel, because the support is here. I think, you know, and it's that team collaboration and the industry just really coming together to help each other. But Jonathan, do you have any thoughts on best practices?
You just have to find a partner. To David's point, you got to find that partner that you can trust. When you have the idea or when you have this problem, you got to know where to go to open the conversation and kind of talk through how to get the problem solved. And that's been, you know, a luxury for me over the course of my relationship with Orbweaver. It's my best practice has always been like, you know, the what ifs, or why does it have to be this way? And I would talk to them and I'll say, hey, is there a solution? Is there something we can do about it? But it's always gone back to that relationship that we have, that trust that we have. And I know that they're going to join me in that journey of trying to figure out how to solve this.
Patrick?
You know, I would say best practices is just, you know, getting the message out. You know, when we started this journey, and put in a whole transformation from a system standpoint. We actually were going around and, you know, talking to all of our customers and explaining to them what we were doing and trying to get them on board and discuss and try to create more enthusiasm for the effort. And so without that, I think a lot of our customers would not have started going down that journey and also adopting a lot of these new platforms and processes.
And so I think for me, it would be, like we spoke about earlier, from the very top, it's a clarity in the vision for what you want to accomplish, and then a commitment to that journey, because it is a journey, not a destination. It's not a big red button or switch that we can push or flip that gets instantaneous results. It's also about being, I think, consistent in the communication to the organization so that they understand what the benefits are and are along contributing on the journey and not blocking or slowing down or worrying about other things, which then creates a space. You know, we talked earlier about skills of the future, and as some of the things that were stated earlier, I think it's about courage in the workforce to be comfortable speaking up and saying, hey, this isn't working quite right, or this is a big challenge for me that I think can be solved with this and other things like that, so that, again, that contributes to that clarity.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much to add. I'll just latch on to David's word of passion, and to drive adoption and change, you've got to have a David Ginsburg in your organization that is going to lead it and be passionate about it. It's the piece that's typically missing when it doesn't work.
So in conclusion, this is a process. It's not going to be perfect, and our channel partners can be the ones offering the support needed along the journey. So that's why that team effort, the channel coming together to support each other. I just want to thank the panelists for being here, for your time and preparation. And it's really been a fascinating conversation. So thank you for being here. And thank you for OpReaver for having the event. Thank you.
Thank you.